it is harder to move profit than it is to move yield. And that once you've seen that, it really does cause you to back up and ask yourself, why has there been so much focus on yield in the first place, given that that really isn't the thing that generates economic welfare for farming households?
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Does relaxing the financial constraints on farmers boost their profits? If small-scale farmers in low-middle-income countries are stuck in a situation where their productivity is low, but a lack of cash means they can't afford better seeds, equipment, fertilizer, then giving them access to money to invest will surely result in higher yields and higher profits. Or will it? Craig McIntosh of UC San Diego is the academic lead on a recent J-PAL policy insight on the link between credit and profitability for farmers. He joins me now. Craig, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hello, Tim. Nice to be here.
Craig, the more research I read on this, the more I'm thinking it must be almost impossible for farmers in these situations to make a profit. Am I right?
Well, I think that is the big picture question that's on the table. Mm-hmm. And that's why we've tried to broaden the insight that we're talking about today a bit to not just think about loans, but to also look at cash transfer programs, essentially to look at everywhere that we can find where we have really cleanly identified studies where folks have relaxed credit constraints for farmers and what happens. Why is that a deep question? I think you have these two versions of reality, right? So in one of them, we have these countries in which, by and large, the Green Revolution has not transpired. Farmers are very poor. It's obviously the case that there are credit constraints. So it might be very natural to think, well, we know what the technologies are to increase productivity. All we have to do is get people liquidity and they're going to be able to do so. In a more unconstrained homo economicus world, we might expect that prior to these interventions, right, farmers had already invested so that marginal revenue equals marginal cost, and that therefore the opportunities they have open to them on the margin are basically going to cost what they return. Thinking broadly about the effect of relaxing credit constraints in agriculture helps to adjudicate between these two worlds, and that's what we're going to be talking about today.
This policy insight, it runs through various pieces of research, various possible ways to help farmers. First of all, the most obvious one is there is microcredit in low middle income countries, surely designed to solve problems exactly like this. What's the uptake among farmers? How useful to them is it?
Yeah, as you say, microcredit is an obvious starting point. It's been around for a long time. We have a lot of good studies on it. It feels as if it should be targeted at this type of person. So we have four studies in the portfolio that look at microfinance directed at farmers. Those studies are in Morocco, Ethiopia, Bangladesh, and Malawi. In general, those studies are actually disappointing. On the demand side, we find that take-up ranges between 13 and 33%. So in none of those studies did more than a third of the farmers offered microfinance loans actually take them.
Why are the others not taking it?
Well, when we dig a little deeper, it may actually be the case that microfinance isn't really the greatest place to start discussing credit in agriculture, because these products are really designed to keep farmers out in many ways. What are the problems? They're pretty obvious. One of them is the typical microfinance loan is maybe 3 months long. You start repaying a week or two after you took the loan. So this is clearly an impossible cash flow to generate with long cycle agriculture. The other issue is at the heart of microfinance are these joint liability structures where the borrowers are supposed to be able to protect each other against default events and bail each other out. Agriculture has the unfortunate feature that since so much default is weather-driven, if one person's in trouble, everybody's in trouble, and the joint liability mechanism falls apart. This is, in some sense, I think, more a feature than a bug from the perspective of microfinance lenders. They very well recognize the dangers in lending to agriculture, and I think in many cases have basically designed microfinance products to keep farmers from using them. The relatively low take-up among farmers, maybe we shouldn't consider it too damning, because these really aren't the credit products that are focused on agriculture in the first place.
Now, I appreciate this is easy for me to say sitting at a desk behind a microphone, but this does not seem like an impossible credit problem to solve. If we could design some kind of credit that was tailored to their situation, what would that be? And is it possible to design it?
Absolutely. So you're completely correct. And of course, you know, there is a very long tradition of agricultural lending all over the earth. So this is certainly something that can be done. Within our portfolio, I think we have a number of interesting credit products that have restructured themselves in different ways to be more suitable for agriculture. So some of those are pretty straightforward. So for example, in Tanzania, a study led by Nakano and co-authors allowed farmers to defer 80% of the payment until after harvest time, right? So pushing the majority of the cash flow back. A study in Ghana by Monica Lambon and co-authors is using digital credit to send credit out to farmers and then giving them a 3-month grace period to repay. So those are things that are basically just creating more flexibility in the repayment structure in a fairly obvious way. Another bundle of lending products is using the fact that there are assets in agriculture that are collateralizable in an unusual way. For example, a study in Kenya by Billy Jack and co-authors looking at dairy farmers. Here, a really key investment is to buy a big water tank that allows you to reliably provide water to the cows. Yeah. This allows them to generate a more regular flow of milk, etc. This is a big, heavy asset that's hard to move. That makes it easy to collateralize. So this study basically looked at different ways of offering credit and found dramatically higher take-up rates for a kind of a leasing-style self-collateralized credit product than a typical joint liability loan. So certainly indication that we can get demand up. I think there's a number of really interesting lending products that we have that are actually taking a completely different tack on the agricultural income cycle. So rather than thinking about the thing that you're trying to do is how do you get credit to be planted in the ground, you're trying to think about the cash flow problems and the price cyclicity that farmers face, and you're trying to be clever about coming up with some different ways of increasing income. So the highest profile of these is this paper by Burke et al. In Kenya. They present the puzzle as sell low, buy high. And I think this is an increasingly important and generally recognized problem that in shallow markets, prices tend to be terrible right at the time that everybody is selling because the markets are flooded with output. And then just a few months later, now the prices have skyrocketed because now everybody is trying to buy back grain to eat during hungry season. And so lots of people who have looked for this are now seeing, you know, price increases on the order of 20 to 40% over the course of just a few months. This is a perpetual trap for farmers, yeah. Right? They're always selling food at bad prices. They're always buying food at bad prices. So why are they doing this? The reason is that they're really desperate for money at the time they harvest. And so this presents kind of an obvious opportunity to use credit to make incomes go up. What they did in Kenya was that they gave loans at harvest time just to allow people to wait a few months to sell. This product had take up of 64% and generated returns of 29% for those farmers. And by allowing some people to come off the market when prices are low and come onto the market when prices are high, they actually flattened out those price trajectories in treatment villages. And so they're actually generating like halo benefits for everyone in the village, even the people who don't take the product. Another study in Burkina Faso by De La Vallade and co-authors used a kind of a more conventional warehouse receipt style system, collateralizing your stored grain, had similar benefits, 15% increases in revenues. That's kind of one angle, which is maybe not so obvious that it's quite a straightforward way in a certain sense to increase agricultural income, even if yields don't change at all. A related but different idea is a study in Zambia by Fink and co-authors. So what they're doing is recognizing that during that hungry season, farmers are desperate to get income, and consequently, they're hiring out a lot of their labor onto neighboring farms in order to be paid these Ganyu wages to have something to eat during the hungry season. So what they were doing was giving loans during the lean season, and contrary to this idea that if I have liquidity, what I'm going to do is invest that liquidity in my soil, what they see is actually that it allows farmers to stop working on other people's farms,
right? Yeah.
Devote more of their labor to their own farms, and then they see an increase in production as a result of that increase in labor devotion, right? So these are, I think, more subtle and in a way more interesting, and they're thinking more carefully about how these cycles affect farmers and how credit constraints cause people to do things that are not in their long-term interests if they had the ability to smooth better over the course of the year.
if you are offering credit to farmers and it is so difficult for farming to make a profit, might they use the credit to do other things, basically anything but farming, that might be more profitable for them?
There certainly is a tendency for farmers to try to diversify their income streams away from agriculture, which is something that is very reasonable for them to do, given that that is, again, another trap that people find themselves in agricultural communities. We have 6 studies that look at transfer programs that are taking place where these studies are measuring both agricultural investment and non-agricultural investment. And interesting, those 6 studies are basically completely split. 3 of them find agricultural households doubling down on farming, investing more in agriculture and being able to increase yields in agriculture. And then the other 3 studies find them using that money to get away from agriculture. In general, the returns that you see from those non-agricultural enterprises are both larger and are also not as highly correlated with the agricultural price cycle as other things are. And so I think there's a fair amount of reason to think that programs that give farmers flexibility to be able to diversify income streams, this is a good thing. And we should not silo agricultural households into a world where we say investment in farming is the only thing that makes sense to do.
We've been talking about this, as you say, as if taking up the credit to invest in agriculture is the only thing to do, but that would rely on that credit working to improve profit. So take me through this. When farmers have access to credit, is this improving their yields?
That is an important precursor question, but possibly not the most important question in the end. So first of all, these more highly tailored agricultural lending products do increase take-up. To a broad order of magnitude, they double it. So take-up goes from something on the order of 20-25% to something on the order of 40-50%. More tailoring, more demand. There should be more scope for impact there. The good news is, yes, farmers are able to increase yields, and farmers are also able to increase revenues. Okay, so in 11 out of the 16 randomized controlled trials that we have in this portfolio that offered either credit or grants, we find that either yields or revenues go up. So the good news here is that we can increase agricultural productivity by increasing capital investment in farming.
Normally, when someone says the good news here, they're about to say, but the bad news is there bad news?
There certainly is, because a key insight in terms of thinking about this as an agricultural economist rather than as an agronomist is that yields are not in and of themselves the purpose of agriculture. That a small family farm is a family business, and the purpose of a family business is to make money. Yes, if I invest more in inputs, I can generate more output. And then the question is, what did that input cost? And so, unfortunately, the picture here is substantially grimmer. Only 2 out of the 10 studies that we have that are RCTs that looked at profits from the agricultural enterprise find that, in fact, profits go up. Going back to where we started the conversation, that we have this more unconstrained view of how these farmers should have been behaving prior to this intervention, if they were already at the point where they had invested until marginal revenue equals marginal cost, it certainly should be the case that they can produce revenues on the margin. It should also be the case that what it costs to produce those revenues is the same as the revenue. And so essentially that's what we're finding overall in the portfolio. So it is the case that 2 out of the 10 studies saw increase in profits. And so I don't mean to paint a universally bleak picture. Clearly, more research needs to be done to really try to focus in on what are the determinants of those contexts where we do see profits go up. But I think the main takeaway here is it is harder to move profit than it is to move yield. And that once you've seen that, it really does cause you to back up and ask yourself, why has there been so much focus on yield in the first place, given that that really isn't the thing that generates economic welfare for farming households?
Now, credit isn't the only tool that we have. There are also things like government subsidies, subsidized fertilizer, for example. What do we know about those programs?
Okay, so this is just a huge debate, and it's been roiling now for 2 decades or more. Probably the flagship debate here is the Malawian Input Subsidy Program, heavily disparaged by World Bank economists at the time that it was introduced, often referred to in Africa as the Malawi miracle, in the sense that, you know, this program does seem to have allowed Malawi to move from being a net importer of maize to being self-sufficient in maize. This has garnered a lot of attention. This is a program that has received a lot of money in sub-Saharan Africa. So we have 10 African countries that have implemented large-scale ISP programs. In those countries, those programs are typically eating up something like a fifth of the total agriculture budget Wow. for the entire nation, right? So these are very expensive programs. They're very large, highly visible. They have very broad reach in the country. As you alluded to at the beginning of the question, in the same way that we can think about either tying credit to the purchase of a specific input or allowing it to be completely general, we can also think about tying subsidies to a specific product or allowing them to be general. So in a sense, a fertilizer subsidy should be thought of as something like a cash transfer, but it's a cash transfer that you only receive if you purchase fertilizer, right? So it's a way of linking the benefit to this very specific thing and trying to drive behavior in a predetermined direction. These programs, I think the broad consensus among economists is that these programs may not have returned what they cost. So there's a very nice study by Tom Jane and co-authors, which is itself a review of 80 non-experimental studies on ISP programs. So their core takeaways are, first of all, the profitability of fertilizer at market prices is questionable in most of sub-Saharan Africa. The targeting of these ISP programs is very problematic. So many of these studies found targeting that is no better than random, and a large number of studies have found politically based targeting of one form or another. So either if you go within a village and you say which farmers in a village are receiving these subsidies, it tends to be farmers that have political connections to the government who get them. And then if you step back and you say which regions of the country are receiving these subsidies, there's a fair amount of evidence that these are getting targeted in electoral pork barrel ways towards politically valuable constituencies. One of the takeaways from the Jane meta study, which I think is sort of consonant with what we find, is that the benefits of an ISP program are likely to be highest if you look in the parts of the country that have the worst market access and where fertilizer use was lowest to begin with, which is, I think, not an illogical place to come to. So we have one really standout study in our RCT portfolio, which is a study done in Mozambique by Michael Carter and co-authors. They find an ISP program is very effective at driving fertilizer use. It's very effective at driving revenues from farming. And it's actually so effective, it generates so much revenue that farmers are reinvesting that revenue in fertilizers. And so they're seeing benefits even 2 or 3 years after those subsidies were offered. That's a blockbuster result. It's really an outlier in our portfolio. And so I think to circle back to Tom Jane's point, Mozambique is a very unusual environment. And in that Carter study, 2/3 of the farmers who were offered that ISP program had never used fertilizer at all prior to the advent of that program. So I think it kind of reinforces this point that if you're using fertilizer subsidies to get fertilizers into parts of the agricultural chain that don't use them, you can expect to see real returns. If you're moving into an environment where you already have private sector delivery of fertilizers, you already have fairly widespread adoption, now you're much more likely to be doing things that are either crowding out or even potentially distorting the way that that market had been working previously.
So what if we simplify things and just give cash to the farmers that need it the most? Does that work?
Okay, so there's obviously just an enormous literature on unconditional cash transfers. And yes. So what we tried to do, I referred to this briefly before, what we tried to do to kind of scope the literature in a way that is relevant to a conversation about agriculture is to find the studies that were randomized controlled trials on cash transfers and that study both agricultural and non-agricultural outcomes. Here we see cash transfers work in the way that most people find that they work, which is these resources are not wasted, they're harbored very carefully, they're put to use. And then we have this split evidence where in some cases they're being put to use in agriculture that can be both investing more money, but also investing more labor, as we discussed in the Malawi case. In general, what we're seeing is a lot of diversification, movement into non-farm enterprises. Study in Zambia, for example, found a doubling of household income coming primarily from the investment of cash transfer in non-farm enterprises. if we focus very narrowly on agriculture, this is a somewhat depressing result that resources on the margin are being used for something else. But again, if we step back and we think about households being trapped in this risk environment where agriculture is just such a hard risk to diversify, this is what we would hope people are doing. They are doing it, and they're doing it successfully. It's just not a farming story.
And what comes through from what you're saying very strongly is that targeting is a really difficult thing to do well. Is part of the problem in increasing profitability that we're not managing to target enough resources at the farmers that struggle the most?
This is a very subtle question in a sense, because when we say targeting well, you know, there are multiple things you could mean by that. And I think the two most obvious things that you might mean, one of them would be targeting poverty well. And, you know, that is something that there's a huge literature on in the cash transfer space. One of the beauties of cash transfers is that they are so incredibly targetable. And so if poverty targeting is what we're attempting to do, cash transfers really stand out as something that it's very easy to target. It's very easy to prevent them from getting captured by politics because everything is so individualized and so visible. Now, on the other hand, you might mean a different thing, which is to say, are we getting liquidity to the people who put liquidity to use well? And I think that is a much more complicated question. When we think about credit, I don't think that there's any inherent reason that you would necessarily want to be giving loans to people who are not engaging in economic activity that generates returns high enough to be able to repay those loans. Targeting a grant and targeting credit are two very different questions. First of all, with credit, you're obviously going to have the supply side constraint, and it's clearly going to be the case everywhere in the world that banks are going to be looking for client bases that have good profitability, that are reliable, et cetera. All of that seems like it should be regressive, and I think there's a large literature saying it is regressive. On the demand side, there's an extremely elegant study that was run in Mali by Beeman and co-authors where they basically first went in a randomized way and offered loans to understand which households would choose to take loans if offered them, and then came in behind that with a randomized control trial that offered grants to people. And so with this design, they're able to back out the returns to capital for people who would borrow and the returns to capital for people who would not borrow. So what they find in that context is that the returns for the people who would borrow are on the order of 130%. So very, very high. These are people who can put capital to use well. They have good things to do with the money. On the other hand, the returns for the people who would not have borrowed are effectively zero. So in other words, credit is self-targeted as you would somehow hope that it would be. Nobody who has an expected return below the interest rate should be borrowing. Is this a positive thing or is it a negative thing? It's obviously regressive. Those profitable farmers have more land, more livestock. They have higher profits in the absence of credit. In every sense, this is economically regressive. And yet at the same time, if you step back and you think about the problem from the perspective of a capital scarce country that wants to put capital into the hands of those people who can use it to generate high returns, this is exactly what you would hope to see. I think basically what this comes down to is that we should expect credit to be regressively targeted in a manner that is potentially inevitably what we need it to be, even if it's economically regressive. And in some sense, that then kind of elevates the role of cash transfers. If we're using them as investment capital, the same argument would hold, and we would say, well, why target cash transfers towards people who aren't going to generate growth with them? But of course, cash transfers also have a safety net consumption logic to them. And almost certainly the welfare from that logic will be substantially higher for very poor farmers. And it's relatively easy to target them in that way.
Craig, where we started with this was you explaining to me just how difficult it is for farmers to increase their profits at all. I've picked that apart by saying, what about this? What about that? That's maybe not the way to think about it at all. It's probably not the way you're thinking about it. There has been some bundling of help for farmers. Has that worked better? What sort of services can we bundle with grants or financial help?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a number of studies where people have used credit as a vehicle to help people take up a costly bundle of other services where Those include a fairly obvious set of candidates, things like improved fertilizer, improved seeds. Soil testing services is something that people are very interested in these days because there's been so little customization of fertilizer in developing countries, and the ministries of agriculture may not be doing fine-grained soil recommendation. And then training and accreditation to help farmers meet export standards is another thing in which there's been quite a bit of work. Clearly, if you can get up and escape your own market and get out into high-value international export markets, this is the kind of thing that we would expect to be able to really be a sea change in the returns available to farmers. The key thing here, though, is that these are projects that are bringing a completely new technological vehicle. They've done their market research. They've looked at what the barriers are. They have a substantive intervention to address those barriers. And now we're really thinking of credit basically as something that allows you to generate take-up. I can come offer an expensive group of things to poor farmers and I get very low take-up because they simply can't afford it. So this is now sort of a different question than the one we were discussing before. It's not relaxing credit constraints in the status quo. It's saying if you had something valuable to invest in and if liquidity were a barrier to that, is credit complementary to getting this better mousetrap taken up by farmers?
What's the policy lesson here on what we can learn on really how to help farmers, how to make credit or any kind of financial help work for them?
First of all, this works. Okay, mm-hmm. So the take-up is high. Many of these studies have a design that lets you think about what the take-up of the product is without credit and what the take-up of the product is with credit. And what we're seeing is that credit is a very important vehicle to helping people adopt these expensive packages of productivity enhancement. A very clean example is a study in Tanzania by Haru and co-authors. So they offered soil testing, they offered vouchers to purchase fertilizer, and then they offered both. And neither of those things on their own does anything. But when you put together the new information with the liquidity to act on the new information, then you see a significant improvement. Again, this is not credit in a vacuum. This is credit as a technology adoption assisting mm-hmm. device. The core takeaway about the status quo of agriculture in our studies is a fairly negative one, which is that whether looking at whether capital is donated or loaned, we might think that that would be a big difference. That doesn't actually turn out to be an enormous difference. The point is, in both cases, the marginal returns under the status quo tend to equal the marginal costs, and it's hard to drive increases in income. The bundling point is kind of turning the horse and the cart around and saying, if you have a technological vehicle that is driving agricultural productivity forward, now credit turns on as an absolutely key constraint, and it's absolutely necessary that you put credit in that bundle in order to allow people to adopt. Stepping back and thinking about how both credit and the technological conveyor belt work in wealthy countries, this is really what it looks like, right? Is that, you know, farmers in the rich world are up to their necks in debt all the time. They are constantly having to make expensive investments in new equipment, new capital, new marketing, new seeds, etc. All of that costs money. That money is typically borrowed. But what the credit is doing is not basically allowing them to just expand scope with a given set of technologies. It's allowing them to stay up on the edge of this technological conveyor belt that is so absolutely critical in agriculture. Credit is, of course, an absolutely key part of the agricultural system, but really the thing that drives productivity in the agricultural system is technological improvement. And what credit can allow farmers to do is to keep up with that technological improvement. Absent the technological improvement, it doesn't seem like there's a tremendous capacity for this to improve things on its own.
It really does make you think about what we are doing in policy terms and how we could do it better. Thank you for talking about it.
Thanks so much, Tim.
This is a JPEL Policy Insight, so to find it, go to povertyactionlab.org and search for Can Relaxing Credit Constraints Boost Farmers' Profits? The academic leads were Craig McIntosh and Tavneek Sori. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. Best way to make sure you don't miss an episode. Subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, at voxdev.org, where there are articles about the topics we feature. If you like what you're hearing, tell someone else about us. Leave us a review. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.